Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, this is Jonathan Shaler on WGTD-FM. I'm your host today for Education Matters, and my honored guest is Dr. Arthur Jensen. He's an emeritus professor of communication and rhetorical studies from Syracuse University. He retired in 2019, but has been quite active since that time, as you will hear. At Syracuse, he served as department chair and as associate dean for academic affairs in the College of Visual and Performing Arts, as well as academic director for the Bachelor of Professional Studies. He's currently a member of the board of stewards for the CMM Institute for Personal and Social Evolution. I hope he'll tell us a little bit about that. And co-director with Robin Penman of the Institute's Cosmopolis 2045 project. And we'll share a website link in our webpage so that you can look that up. His scholarship is focused on ways in which communication patterns create and sustain social identities and relationships, and exploring the potential of a cosmopolitan form of communication as a social practice. Don't worry, we will be getting definitions here. His writing includes several books, the most recent of which are A Call to Cosmopolitan Communication, A Narrative of Richness and Mystery, and Making Better Social Worlds, Inspirations from the Theory of the Coordinated Management of Meaning with Robin Penman. A textbook, Interpersonal Communication, co-authored with Sarah Trenholm, is currently under revision for an 8th edition with Cognella Publishing. So welcome, Arthur. It's a delight to have you here. I should mention, in terms of full disclosure, that you and I come from the same intellectual heritage, having both studied as graduate students at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst during what I would call the golden age of Dr. Barnett Pierce and Vernon Cronin and their colleagues. Just a wonderfully generative time, very exciting time. And I know that for both of us, a lot of our thinking and a lot of our approach to teaching and research comes from our schooling at that time. So, of course, we've evolved, and you're going to tell us about how you've evolved and what brought you to write this wonderful book, A Call to Cosmopolitan Communication. What is this book, and how did you come to write it?
Well, first, thank you, Jonathan, for having me. Sure. And I do very much value the same heritage that we share, learning from Barnett Pierce and Vernon Cronin was very formative in terms of my career, and I think yours as well. So, but the book I shared with you a little earlier, that as I was nearing retirement, several of my colleagues asked me, why didn't I just leave the dark side of being in the dean's office and come back to faculty? And I said, well, I would do that, except the day job's just getting in the way of what I really want to do, which is to write. And this book was on my mind at that time, and I had fits and starts of putting the book together. But essentially, there were, I think, three motivations that that led to writing the book. One was that I was deeply influenced by Barnett Pierce's book in 1989, The Communication and the Human Condition. In that book, he articulated the beginnings of a cosmopolitan form of communication, contrasting it with what he called ethnocentric forms of communication and modernistic forms. So I wanted to do, I wanted to explore that, and had been exploring that for several years. You mentioned the Cosmopolis 2045 project and its website, which was one way of trying to articulate what a cosmopolitan frame, if it were taken seriously, what it would look like in terms of a social community. So we imagined a social community set in the year 2045 that had been practicing cosmopolitan communication for some time. And how would it function? How would it be different from other communities? So we had just finished the beginning, you know, the first round or first draft of the website. So I was really looking to try to articulate in written form What is cosmopolitan communication? How can it be useful to us? What are the challenges? What are the implications and limitations? So that was certainly one motivation. And it was also connected very much so to the political divide that we're experiencing in this country and around the world over the last few years. The forms of communication that are dominant in our culture are either ethnocentric or modernistic, and I can get into how did we define those a little bit later, but they have largely failed us. We don't have good practices in terms of how to have conversations when we differ in our opinions or our values, our beliefs, and so on. And cosmopolitan communication is at least an attempt to find different ways of engaging in those conversations more productively. So that was one motivation. A second motivation was, as you know, Barnett Pierce died in 2011, so it's been about a decade. And there really hasn't been any, at least that I know of, any really updated articulation of CMM. And so I wanted to do that. There were some things that some of the models in CMM that I felt could be explored a little bit more in depth and modified. And so that's part of the book, especially the hierarchy model of how we manage meanings. I tried to do some different things with that in the book. And then I guess the third motivation was coordinated management meetings, CMM theory, is a social constructionist theory. It grows out of a view that we create the social worlds that we participate in through our everyday communication, conversations, the ways in which we interact with each other. And a lot of people in our field, communication studies and psychology and other related social sciences, have really lived off of a different model, which is that there's some basic aspects of human nature that are foundational, they're fundamental, they're essential, and our research is to try to discover those characteristics. And so I refer to that as a more traditional model of communication. But what I had been reading about and finding is that the new research on brain science, neurobiology, has been confirming that the social constructionist model has a lot of support. Just in terms of the more we learn about how the brain works, there's a realization that the brain is a social organ, that it very much responds to the social environment and especially to social relationships and patterns of interaction, so much so that the very neural patterns of our brains are altered by the forms of interaction we engage in, by the quality of social relationships. So I wanted to bring that into an understanding of CMM and the sort of the support for the basic viewpoint that underlies CMM. Mm.
So. Do you remember the, I'm going to share one of my first aha experiences and then ask you if you can recall an early aha experience when the CMM model or some part of it and the whole social constructionist view of communication kind of clicked for you. I remember as an undergraduate studying with Barnett Pierce at the University of Massachusetts, the whole idea of framing and reframing really was an eye-opener for me. There's a quotation that Barnett threw out. I'm not going to recall the source. I don't know if you know it, but something along the lines of that which cannot be denied may be reconstrued. And I always loved that quote because it reminded me that I have the power to reframe my own experience. In any case, I was playing a game of tennis pairs with another couple, and the other team hit the ball on the line on our side. Three of us called it in, one of us called it out, and we got into an argument. I looked at my watch. We had 10 minutes left on the court, and I said to the one person, the outlier, who was holding their position, that this ball was out, and we were stymied by this. I said, well, we could spend the next 10 minutes. We have 10 minutes left. We could spend the next 10 minutes arguing about that, or we could get in 10 more minutes of tennis. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And it just took us out of that frame, right? And moved us forward. Yeah. So that for me was an experience where I then said, hey, that's how it works. You can actually use this in your interaction.
Yeah. That's great.
How about you? Have you, might be a more recent one, but have you had those moments? I'm sure.
For me, I don't think it was one specific moment or you know, even any very dramatic moments. It was just a slow realization that the more I read, the more I kind of grasped what I think Barnett and Vernon were getting at. It just started to drive home the point that this is why cultures differ. This is why people who are raised in very different circumstances think differently and interact differently and so on. That, you know, they're in the midst of a social community in which some things work better than others, or some things are more valued. So, you know, that it's that understanding that these values really do matter. They explain why we take on such different forms of life. Mm-hmm. And but it was, I guess I could say one of the things I remember reading that really struck me was some writing by Sir Isaiah Berlin. And he went back to 18th century writers like Johann Herder, who first articulated, I think, the notion that every culture has its own center of gravity that matters to that group and to those people. And it's what they live for. It's why they live. And if you were to try to convince them to change their values, their beliefs, you'd really undermine all the motivation they have for all the things they do. And so Herder was a big proponent of, I would like to see every culture reach its full potential and go in so many different ways that there would be such a richness about that, that there would be much for all of us to learn from. And I think reading that really drove home the point to me that cultures are diverse, and rightly so, and it makes perfect sense why they are, and it's something to be celebrated, not just in a limited way by eating each other's food or something like that, but really trying to appreciate and understand the goals and motivations of that really exist in different cultures and different ways of being.
Yeah, and a question popped into my mind. The tough question that everybody hates because it's used so often, and that is, but what about the Nazis? That was a cultural phenomenon.
Should we
honor the richness and diversity of that culture?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's that this view that I'm articulating, or that Herder or Isaiah Berlin or Barnett or Vernon, I don't think the view supports the idea that as humans we never make mistakes, or as cultures we never make mistakes. We can have an inauthentic version of what we say are our beliefs or our standards or our values. So it doesn't prevent us from going off in very dangerous and damaging directions. But I think it's important to not go to the other extreme of articulating that there's one set of universal human values that we all should subscribe to. So it's, if you're looking at two ends of the spectrum, I think there's mistakes can be made at both ends.
Yeah. So what is communication and what is cosmopolitan communication in a nutshell?
In a nutshell. Well, I would argue that communication is something that happens between people. It's not something that is formed in our minds and then expressed. It's not so much an individual accomplishment. I know we talk about people having communication skills, and we even included on our resumes, that I have terrific interpersonal skills. But it's really, communication is something that happens between people, and it's in that interaction, in the moments of my doing something and you're doing something in response. That's what communication is all about. It's paying attention to the patterns of interaction and what are the consequences of those patterns of interaction. So that, at least for me, communication is something to be looked at as a dynamic between people, as opposed to a skill set or a mindset or something of that nature.
So kind of paying attention to what we're making together, or?
Yes, very, very much so. And in fact, as you know, one of the phrases that pops out of the lips of members of the CMM community is this notion that we get what we make, or that we make the social worlds that we then live in. And of course, that making process is not limited just to you and me in our interaction. It's also thousands of conversations that have preceded us that have informed our culture, informed our social groups or our families or whatever. So that it's not just what happens in this particular moment, but how what has happened in other moments of interaction and moments of communication have shaped how we got to this point in time and why we're interacting the way we do.
So as we're having a conversation or an interaction and we are attending to what we're making together, what should we be looking for, and what do we do with that information?
Well, I think the pattern, the term patterns is important, I think, in this regard, in that, you know, no single act of communication means anything on its own. It means something based on how the other person responds to it. And your response to what I say and my response to what you then say, and that pattern, as it emerges, takes a shape. And so we need, that's what we pay attention to. And I know that Barnett and some of his later writing, well, I was saying that Barnett Pierce asked some really interesting questions of, as we observe patterns of interaction as they unfold between us. One of the questions we can ask is, how did we make that pattern? What did we do in our turn, in our respective turns at talk, that helped to create that pattern? And then a second question is, do we like what we've created? Is that something, it's kind of like your tennis example. Which of these two options do we want? Do we want to pursue arguing about whether the ball hit the line or not, or do we want to continue playing? Those are options in terms of how the pattern will go next. And so I think you can talk about attending to the pattern, judging that pattern, whether it's productive, whether it's helpful or harmful or whatever it might be, and then acting into the moment to change the pattern if we think it's going in a direction that's not good for us. So
that's helpful. Sense. Could you possibly use some of this CMM terminology, these grand terms of coherence, coordination, and mystery, and tell us what they mean generally, and then also how they're distinctive in cosmopolitan communication?
Sure. I actually think those three terms are central to the theory. So coordination, coherence, mystery. Coordination refers to how we're acting together. So it's when we talk about patterns, we're really talking about observable behavior, what you say, what I do, how we respond non-verbally. All of that is part of what is coordinated in our conversation. It's the behavioral acts that we engage in sequence. Coherence refers to the kind of sense we make out of the pattern that we are participating in. How do we judge it? How do we evaluate it? How do we interpret it in light of our relationship? How do we interpret it in light of our social commitments, our political commitments, our religious commitments, whatever it might be? That is what we refer to as coherence being sense-making. And most of the time in communication studies, the argument is that communication is about creating shared meaning, you know, coming to the same meaning or the same kind of coherence as the other person. I think one of the things that Barnett and Verne really contributed to the whole field of communication is the notion that our sense making can be different for each of us, that we shared meaning is not the be all and end all. It sounds like something we would want, but a lot of times we derive different meanings from interaction. We never talk about it. We don't make it explicit that it's not shared meaning. And we each might take from that conversation something valuable to us. So coherence is how we make sense out of the actions that we're engaged in. And there are different ways of making coherent sense out of our interaction. I suppose it's when we can't quite understand what's happening is when things seem incoherent to us, that we just can't figure out why we're engaged in this pattern and what to do about it. And then mystery is the term that has become my favorite term, and it's the one that most fits with a cosmopolitan sensibility or ethic or point of view, whatever you want to call it. And mystery, I think of mystery as just a great reminder that whatever sense making we're engaged in, or whatever kind of pattern we're enacting in terms of coordination, there's always another way we could have done that, or another way we could make sense out of it, or a way we might make sense out of it 10 minutes from now that's different from what we made, how we interpreted things in the moment. So mystery is the sense that the human stories are diverse and many, and we can draw on any number of stories that are part of our lives or part of our culture to make sense in the moment. But there is always another story that might have been more applicable or more interesting or could have taken us in a different direction. So it's that the idea that whatever sense we've made of things, there could always be another way of making sense of things, so that any particular act of sense making is local, it's partial, it's incomplete, it could have been otherwise. And I think when we take that point of view, when we include the concept of mystery in our thinking, we become much less married to specific interpretations of what's happening. And it gives us a kind of a freedom, if you will, or a flexibility such that we don't have to judge each other negatively when we interpret things differently from each other.
So the emphasis is on coordination then, rather than coherence in cosmopolitan communication.
It is. And I think in terms of, one of the ways of defining cosmopolitan communication, I like to say it's at the heart of cosmopolitan communication is being curious about different ways of being, really acknowledging that as important as the way I live my life and the values I hold dear, as important as they are, I have to grant that same level of importance and significance to others who might hold different values as is core to their way of life or their way of being. And when we do that, then we're going to naturally come into differences of opinion or different sets of beliefs or values. And it's what we do about that difference that matters. So from a cosmopolitan perspective, we try to coordinate those differences with each other, as opposed to my trying to persuade you that I'm right, or in cultural terms, instead of assimilating, anybody who comes to the United States has to become true Americans or something of that nature. Mm. It's instead of assimilating, instead of ignoring the differences altogether, which we often do, we are quite skilled, I think, at not paying attention to difference when it's right in front of our face. We just assume that others think like we do, or that even though they say they think differently, we think, deep down they really believe what I believe. So we can either ignore the differences, we can try to assimilate them or persuade others to come into our way of thinking. Or I suppose the other thing that we often do is tolerate difference in a kind of in a passive way. We sort of passively accept that there are differences without trying to coordinate, understand, learn from each other. So in that sense, cosmopolitan is about coordinating differences as best we can.
Great. Just need to take a moment to remind people that they're listening to WGTD-FM. This is Education Matters with your host, Jonathan Shaler, and our guest, Arthur Jensen, the author of A Call to Cosmopolitan Communication. That's our topic right now, is cosmopolitan communication. Some of these ideas that we've been discussing, Arthur, really interest me in terms of the current social divides that we are experiencing here in the United States and also worldwide to some extent. There's variations, obviously, but what I'm thinking of and run into quite frequently, both in my community and on campus, are divides over whether or not the United States is an inherently racist society, what should be taught about race in schools, beginning from the earliest ages on. And race is one. And then another big one, of course, is gender and sexual orientation, the LGBTQA plus curriculum, if you want to call it that. So there's a parent group in my town that is very alarmed by what they see as the indoctrination in both public schools and in colleges and universities on these issues. And they're calling for change. So how does a cosmopolitan, from whatever position in that argument, begin to approach this?
Yeah, these are not easy issues. So just adopting a cosmopolitan perspective doesn't necessarily lead to immediate solutions, immediate satisfaction. But what a cosmopolitan approach asks us to do is to look at more than one point of view, and to recognize that our own values, it's not a zero-sum game. Our own values don't have to suffer because someone else has a different belief or a different way of thinking or a different way of being. So on issues like gender and sexuality or race, I think we tend to make it so much of a zero-sum kind of circumstance, so that if we teach diversity in schools, somehow we'll lose our traditional views and values of what it means to be American. And it simply, in my view, doesn't have to be that way. So that the cosmopolitan approach would try to bring those elements into conversation and talk about ways that we can have productive conversations, as opposed to being so, I don't know what the right term is, firm in our views, that we can't see any other way and that we feel threatened by any other point of view.
Yes, that's a good answer. I'm always the one for the scenario. So I hope you don't mind. I'm going to give you a scenario and ask you to talk into it. So let's say you're on a school board and you get a complaint from several parents that they've heard that a teacher is teaching her third graders about systemic racism. And as part of that, there was a lesson where she had students line up in order of privilege. And she was singling out students, including the children of these aggrieved parents, and saying, you're white, you need to acknowledge your privilege. And if you don't, then you're part of the problem. Their children came home distraught. They feel like they were being blamed and shamed, and the parents are furious about this. What do you do as a school board member? There's an easy one for you. Don't hate me. Don't hate me, Arthur.
I won't. I would want the parent and the teacher to sit down together and to I'd like for the teacher to explain what their goals were, what they were trying to accomplish in using that particular exercise. And perhaps to say, you know, I would ask the teacher, would you do it the same way? You know, if you were to do it again, would you do it the same way? Did you intend for those children to go home distraught? And if not, what could you do differently so that that the important lesson you want to convey can be learned without making your students, some of your students, feel that they are, you know, that they're they're implicated in such a way that they don't even know what to do about it, because these are not conversations we normally have. And so the first time you have a conversation like that, it's easy to understand why people feel threatened or challenged, or like they're being singled out as part of a problem or something like that. So that at least my first attempt would be a conversation between parents and teacher, and to try to even to ask the parents, how would you want the teacher to do this differently? And of course, if the argument gets into, well, there's no such thing as white privilege, then we're probably at an impasse, right? But at least let's not assume that's where we're going to start. And hopefully we can have a more productive conversation.
Very interesting. Yeah. One of our colleagues, go ahead.
I was just going to say quickly, it points to one of the things that I did write about in the book is you have to look at the limits of a cosmopolitan approach. It's an invitation to others to engage in a certain kind of conversation. And if they refuse or don't want to participate in that conversation, then it can't work. It will fail by definition. So we may have to resort back to something more modernistic in terms of or, you know, going back to arguments and evidence and all those sorts of things. But you know, just we need to make more of an attempt, I think, at trying what we call a cosmopolitan sensibility or perspective.
This is very interesting to me as a practitioner of conflict resolution, as a mediator. These concepts are very helpful to me. And as you were talking through that school board example, I was thinking of a friend and colleague of mine. He's now deceased. Maybe you knew him, Bill Wilmot, who wrote on conflict resolution, was a mediator himself. Remember one time at lunch, he wanted to pick his brain for his best practices in mediation. And one thing he said that was very interesting to me was that in any mediation, he would not bring two opposed parties into the room together until he had first met with each of them individually and had an extended conversation in those spaces where, you know, he had a kind of running start in terms of people feeling heard, people feeling safe, people being able to unfold their positions, and then bring them together. And yeah, I thought that was good advice. Yeah,
that is good advice, and that would make sense in the scenario you painted. That would make a lot of sense.
So more talk about cosmopolitan communication. If this were to be taught throughout the curriculum, as you can see, I've already bought into it. I'm assuming that this is a good idea. Well, I should ask you, I know what you're going to say, but I want you to defend your idea here. Why would this be a good idea to teach throughout the curriculum, obviously in different ways at different levels? And how could it be done, or should it be done?
Well, I would start first with the notion that as an adult, it's very difficult to learn new ways of being, new ways of practice. And even though I have taught and lived this cosmopolitan perspective for a number of years, it's so easy to fall back into old habits of communication practices that you know are not productive, but you just feel compelled. And I'll give you a quick example before we go to the next generation. During the 2016 presidential election, the debates between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, my wife and I were watching the debate, and I believe it was at the point where Trump was standing behind Clinton as she was speaking, and it appeared to be an obvious attempt to intimidate her in some way. And of course, I'm just yelling back at the television saying, what is he doing? What is wrong with this man? And I, several repeated parts of the, in repeated parts of the debate, I would get angry at the television or at Trump in terms of his behavior. And my wife just very calmly, quietly said to me, how's that cosmopolitan thing going? It was a reminder that I've slipped back into some other form of communication. Mm. But my argument would start with the idea that as adults, it's difficult enough to learn new ways of thinking, new ways of being, ways of communicating. So that if we start with children at a young age and help them learn to examine alternative points of view, to think more about the how their behavior impacts on the other, essentially to learn how to manage their emotions in more productive ways, then that sets the sort of foundation, if you will, for learning some of these more complicated responses or ways of thinking as an adult. So I just think if we start at a young age, helping children understand what is essentially a cosmopolitan perspective, but we would obviously wouldn't call it that. And as you know, we do have such a set of teaching tools called Cosmo Kids, developed by Kim Pierce. It's a program called Cosmo Kids. And it is essentially starts in, I think, from ages 3 to 5. And then there's Cosmo Tweens and Cosmo Teens. And there are different sets of materials that are designed as age appropriate ways of engaging young students in managing conflict situations or managing situations such as, where one student feels excluded by the group or other kinds of situations, situations in which it's easy to get angry. There are tools designed to help teachers work with students to think through those interactions and identify more productive ways of handling them. Mm. And the results so far have been amazing. There's a number of schools utilizing these materials in several different countries. United States, I think there are 5 or 6 different regions in the United States where this is being taught, in Arizona, in Louisiana, Massachusetts, some other areas as well, and in 3 or 4 different countries around the world. So that, but what's reported back to us by the teachers, especially, is that they are experiencing less volatile behavior on the part of their mm-hmm. students as a result of, it's usually about 15 minute exercise once a day in the school curriculum.
Wow.
And it involves students with, they take a scenario like you gave me, scenario, yep. and play it out, and they say, here's a young boy who's just joined our class and he's sitting over by himself and no one's talking to him. How do you think he feels? How would you feel if you were that young boy? What could you do to help make that person feel more included or feel better? Mm-hmm. And the teachers can do these lessons with puppets and all kinds of ways that really engage the students. And when that's done repeatedly, week after week after week, the kids start to call themselves Cosmo Kids, and they start to talk to each other, and they'll say, we're not being Cosmo Kids. This is not what Cosmo Kids would do. And so it's really having an impact on the lives of students. And the teachers report that their parents are when they talk to the parents, a lot of times they'll get parents saying, what are you doing to my child? They're having fewer arguments with their brother and sister, or they're much more affirmative, or they're more positive in their interactions at home, and it's reflecting beyond just the school setting. So I do think that's a very good place to start,
Cosmo and, Kids is a, and is that, that that has an unusual spelling, doesn't it? Isn't it C-O-Z?
Yeah, it's C-O-S, C-O-S-M-O, and then capital K-I-D-Z. Oh. So
okay,
the kids,
C-O-S-M-O,
kids part has the Z.
Capital K-I-I-C, K-I-D-Z. And it's Kimberly Pierce, and I looked up the other name. You can check me on the pronunciation. Marit Havim?
Marit Havim, yes.
Yes, H-A-A-V-I-M-B. And I think there's a recent addition to the team who's working on the improv part of it, Dan Weissman.
Yes, the original version was Cosmo Kids, which was for ages, I think, 3 to 5. And or grades 3 to 5, not ages 3 to 5, grades 3 to 5. And then Cosmo Tweens was a set of materials developed largely in interaction with tween-aged students. And then now the Cosmo Teens effort is led by Don Wasserman. Yes. Mm-hmm. And my understanding, I haven't been involved in that planning very closely, but my understanding is that they're making great strides in developing materials, and that students, again, students themselves are at the heart of developing the materials for that age group.
That's great.
So I'm really looking forward to the what the product looks like that they come up with.
Well, gee, Arthur, you won't believe this, but we're almost out of time. So it went by very quickly. I was going to ask you what you would add to the book if you were to write it today. If you can answer that in 30 seconds. And well, any other final thoughts?
Yeah, I'll say this. One of the things I've been reading a lot about lately is the study of emotions. And there are two books. One is by Elizabeth Feldman Barrett called How We Make Emotions. Or you know, How Emotions Are Made. And the second book by Batya Mesquita, who is a Dutch psychologist, and her book is entitled Between Us, How Cultures Create Emotions.
Mm.
And of all the social behavior that has been explored, the study of emotions is the one that has been articulated as having a universal appeal or universal kind of status in that it's believed that we developed the emotional strata that we have as a process through a process of evolution.
Hmm.
But both of these authors are saying that the research on especially the brain science, but also the research interacting with people and interviewing people from different cultures about how they do emotions suggests that they that culture and social interaction shapes the emotional goals, the goals that emotion is used to orient toward, and that these goals are different in different cultures. So naturally, the emotions are different, and so happiness does not mean the same thing in the United States as it does in many collective cultures. So I would incorporate more of that in the book because I think it supports the notion.
Fantastic. Well, Arthur, this has been a real delight for me, and I'm sure for our audience. Thank you for this. Arthur Jensen is the author of A Cosmopolitan Sensibility, Compelling... that's another one in the series. Sorry. He's the author of A Call to Cosmopolitan Communication, A Narrative of Richness and Mystery. The other one that I mentioned is a kind of case study collection that follows from that view, so that I would also recommend that book, edited by Robin Penman. That one is A Cosmopolitan Sensibility. Anyway, what you've been listening to is WGTD FM's Education Matters with your host Jonathan Shaler and our guest this week, Dr. Arthur Jensen. Thank you.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at wgtd.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Weston Museum of Fine Art and Racine offers Wisconsin Photography 2022. This year's exhibition features 113 works by 81 artists. More information available on the website of the Racine Art Museum. This is WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College, and Jenny Tunk.